Okay, we might get started. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this session, which is based on the paper Rebalancing Revisited by Sid Bone and Andrew Goddard. Sid was, until recently, CEO of the Victorian Funds Management Corporation, a role he had held until since October 2004. Before that, Sid spent 6 years as Managing Director of the Asia Pacific Operations of Baring Asset Management, a member of the ING Group. Sid also worked across actuarial and asset consulting roles at Towers Perrin, where over 17 years he held roles at various locations, including Melbourne, Hong Kong and New York. Sid has recently been appointed a Director of the International Centre for Pension Management and is a member of the Victorian Finance Industry Council. Andrew Goddard is Managing Director of Andrew Goddard Consulting. This firm provides actuarial investment and general consulting services to superannuation and other funds, investment managers and governments. A particular area of practice is advice concerning investment in private market assets and asset classes. Until February 2008, Andrew was Director of Alternate Assets and Strategies at Russell Investments, and this role entailed managing research into investment opportunities in the areas of private equity, infrastructure, timberland and funds of hedge funds. So I understand the presentation goes for around 25 minutes and hopefully that will leave plenty of time over for discussion. And now I'll hand over to Sid for the first part of the presentation.
Good afternoon, everybody. Am I awake? Thanks for coming along. Thanks, Michael, for that great introduction. Makes me feel quite old, actually. As you'll see in a moment, this approach to rebalancing that we'll describe to you has delivered pretty interesting results, quite good results if you followed it through the current crisis. So just in case you think we wrote it to try and demonstrate a way of doing things better, the actual genesis of it is a little bit older than that. It actually goes back to my last actuarial paper. I don't know how many in the audience would remember this, because it's 1989. It was entitled Funding in Volatile Conditions. Nick's nodding there, so that's at least one. And the paper looked at ways of sort of smoothing the changes in the solvency ratio of defined benefit plans and looked at ways of stabilising contribution rates. And it looked purely on the funding side, and I remember at the time that I felt that it would be worth investigating the asset side of the equation as well to see if there was a better way of sort of managing the outcome, particularly the solvency ratio. So this has been nagging away at me for pretty close to 20 years. And with the current crisis, it got to the point where I said to Andrew, really, we need to do something. And Andrew was good enough to help me put in a whole lot of hard work to create the paper you've now got. So that's the background to it. The concept is really very simple. Rebalancing, of course, is traditionally done between asset classes in a portfolio of assets. At the moment, of course, a lot of institutional investors are finding that quite difficult, letting their strategic asset allocations to drift. So it is quite topical to look at rebalancing. What this paper looks at is rebalancing not just between the asset classes, but back to what you're trying to invest for in the first place, which is the liabilities, and to find a way to do that on an ongoing basis, and not wait to that sort of triennial asset and liability modelling exercise. It's as simple as that. And we'll try and describe the benefits of this approach to insurance companies, defined benefit funds, and, by adaption, to the defined contribution world. So that's basically what it's about. The key messages, right off the bat, it's quite interesting that we found that you can actually generalise this to almost any preset target. It doesn't have to be the liabilities as such. As long as we have a preset but reasonably achievable target established in advance. And then with that in mind, periodically rebalancing back to that reference point. Now, targets, what could they be? Well, we've nominated, in the case of insurance companies or defined benefit plans, the ratio of assets to liabilities. Not new to this audience, solvency ratio. But it could also be something like an investment return target, very typical in defined contribution, say CPI, inflation plus 5% per annum as a target. And then what you do is you rebalance to that, rebalance depending on how the portfolio is going relative to that target. So if you're running well ahead of target, rebalance back. If you're behind, then take action to put more risk on the table. And this paper demonstrates through a very simple model, under a whole lot of scenarios over the last 100 years, that it actually does potentially better than the traditional rebalancing between the asset classes only. And that's in relation to the magnitude of drawdowns in difficult years, like what we've just experienced, lower volatility in that target ratio, and potentially higher and even less volatile investment returns. So quite interesting outcomes, albeit a simple model. Now, the reality of life is that this target rebalancing is contrarian in nature, like any rebalancing process. So what it requires is when you're in surplus relative to your target, when you're starting to get well ahead, then there's a requirement to start reducing exposure to those risky assets, like equities, in advance. And when in deficit, of course, vice versa. Now, if an institutional investor had adopted this approach over the last decade, then what would have happened, interestingly, is that risky assets would have been progressively underweighted through to 2007, as the returns from markets ran well ahead of any reasonable target. Surplus was being built up in most plans or insurance company assets. And it was time to sort of take risk off the table. If it's too good to be true, perhaps it is, that type of thinking. The quid pro quo, of course, is that that was very good for 2008. The quid pro quo is that by now this approach would be calling for investors to actually start putting risk back into the portfolio. And that's an issue that's going to be difficult for many trustee boards and so on to actually do in practice. So it's relatively straightforward to see how this can be applied in an insurance and defined benefit world, but it can be, as I said earlier, it can be adapted given that any target would work, even CPI plus 5%. And that brings it into the realm of member choice. Now, interestingly, as we all know, individuals in funds tend to do or make investment choices that are in exactly the opposite direction to what we're talking about here with target rebalancing. And what we show in this paper over time is that you get a mirror image of the asset allocation varies in 180 degrees to what we're proposing, and that the investment outcomes are pretty poor, as you might expect. So that, in a nutshell, is what the paper's about. I'm going to hand over to Andrew Goddard now to take you through some of the findings we've got from the paper, and then I'll finish up.
Thank you, everybody, for being here, and I hope all this is useful to you. Sid and I had some fun working on this for quite a long time. So, apart from the paper that you've got, if anybody is interested in any more underlying detail, there's a lot of work underlying the paper as well. What I'm going to do now is to give a very straightforward overview of a very simple model that we put together. And in fact, I'm then going to go through an example of how the model worked. And it's just one of many things that we looked at and one of many things that are covered in the paper. And in fact, you'll notice on this slide here we have two measures of liability. After describing them, I'm going to ignore the accounting one, but it's simply because we only have so much time today. The idea here is that we know that at the end of the day we have a fixed liability of $100. Then we look at what the present value would have been at various prior dates. So the blue line is simply discounting that $100 at 9% per annum compound, which you can think of, if you like, as CPI plus 5. The red line, on the other hand, is discounting the liability at the 10-year bond rate at the date at which the discounting is carried out. So that's more like an accountant's valuation of the liability. So this is how we set our liability target in the model when we were looking at a simple model of a defined benefit fund or an insurance fund. Now, the next slide is quite important. Concentrate, if you will, on the left-hand bar. If I might use the laser pointer a bit here. This line here is supposed to represent a situation where assets are equal to liabilities. And in that case, the model invests 60% in equity and 40% in bonds as a typical portfolio that you might use. Moderate risk, balanced portfolio. Now, this is where the contrarian bit comes in. If we get in surplus, so we have more assets than liabilities, the excess assets are not invested 60-40 equity and bonds, but invested 100% in bonds. So we're reducing our exposure to equity, the risky asset. And the other side of the coin here, if we don't have enough assets to meet the liabilities, then we end up with more than 60% in equities and less than 40% in bonds. So that's the model. It's about the simplest approach we could come up with for putting a bias of this type in. And I'm now going to show you some results. This shows over the last 10 years the progress of the blue line, the actuarial liabilities moving to $100. It also shows you if you had started off with that amount of money, exactly equal to liabilities at the beginning of the 10-year period, and you'd then invested it in a fixed 60-40 asset allocation, the green line, which is a little bit hard to see, shows you the path that the assets would have followed over that 10-year period. And the other line, the colour of which is maybe a bit hard to see, but it's this other line here, shows the path that the assets would have followed had our contrarian model been applied. Now, we'll go into this in a bit more detail in a minute. What you can see is that we're actually in front here, and we're in front here. Most of the time, we're doing slightly better, and we have a significantly, I think, superior result and smoother ride, but more detail to follow. The next slide actually gives you a bit of detail of the investment environment over the last 10 years. So the first point to note is over on the right-hand side here, you can see the aggregate returns that have been achieved by the asset classes over that period, and they're not that unusual. We have equity achieving 7.9% per annum, bonds 5.7%, and interestingly enough, the 60-40 portfolio also achieves exactly 7.9%. But as we all know, although the overall result for the 10 years may not be particularly unusual, the individual years are far from normal. We've got this strong bull run here, and then the global financial crisis event that we're all very familiar with. So that's the background of what's going on. And this is the equity percentage that the model would have chosen, compared with the red line, which is just the fixed 60% in equities throughout. And what's happened is that where the assets fell behind the liabilities, the model increases exposure to risky assets, and then as we get into the bull run period and the assets get in front of the liabilities, the model, if you like, puts money away for a rainy day and reduces the exposure to the risky asset. And then here, as Sid mentioned, it kicks in again and takes it up at the end of the period. So the timing, it works quite well, and you'll see what it actually achieved. This, again, this is a little bit like a version, I suppose, of the first graph that I showed, except it shows the ratios rather than the absolute values. So it shows the same features. The contrarian approach has provided superior outcomes in terms of the asset to liability ratio. Now, before actually showing you the alpha results, I better tell you what we mean by alpha here. We actually mean the extent to which we've outperformed investing in a fixed 60% equity, 40% bond portfolio. So, with that definition, how did we go? The explanation of the different colours here, by the way. The colour is red if the return on a 60-40 portfolio was positive that year, and the colour is blue if the return on a 60-40 portfolio was negative. And it's interesting to see that whilst the approach has given away some performance here, when it took the risk off the table, it's more than recovered it here. And we found that this is a fairly typical feature of what the model does. This has all been summarised here in numerical format. Just going through it quickly, you'll see that we have better returns with lower standard deviation. We have higher asset to liability ratio with lower standard deviation. The biggest reduction in the asset liability ratio is smaller, and we have some alpha. Now, obviously, exactly how this works out depends on precisely when you start, precisely what your targets are, and so forth. And we run through quite a few examples of this in the paper. We deal with the Great Depression, we deal with the inflationary period of the 80s, and if you haven't looked at it yet and you have the chance to, I think you'll find that quite interesting. What I'm now going to do is a slight change of topic, really, within this same theme. Sid mentioned that we could extend the approach to member investment choice. And before I show you the results, though, I want to talk about this behavioural finance thing, the casino effect. That's when somebody wins at the casino, they feel wealthier and they feel that they're prepared to take more risk. And the equivalent thing in member investment choice world is that when people are in front, they're inclined to have more exposure to risky assets, and when they're behind, they tend to go into cash. And this, again, is a simple model of that behaviour. It's almost... you'll see it's almost a reflection of the model that we use for our contrarian rebalancing. And you won't be surprised, I think, to see that it doesn't actually work very well on the whole. So with a target now of achieving a return of 5% above CPI on our assets as our, if you like, our liability concept, this is how it works out. Over the last 10 years, three lines again. So the horizontal one is the comparison of fixed 60% in equities. Then we have the this one here, the blue line, which is the contrarian one, and the green one
is the casino approach, which puts on risk as the bull market fund is going ahead. This is the equivalent of the asset to liability ratio. It's the, we call it the wealth to benchmark ratio. It's the ratio of the assets to how the assets would have grown if they'd achieved CPI plus 5. And again, it's a little bit hard to see here, but we do have the blue line, the contrarian approach, running ahead here and ahead here, and in fact, it's the only one of the three which actually is above 1 at the end of the 10-year period. If we give this whole process longer to run and more opportunity to work, not surprisingly, it works better. Here we see the same thing run over 20 years. And what's interesting here is that the risk has been taken completely off the table. I should explain that we put some upper and lower bounds on the equity exposure that we were prepared to let the model provide to us, 20% above and 20% under, so somewhere between 40 and 80%. We thought that was realistic for a member investment choice concept. Arbitrary decision. But here all the risk is off because the model can easily achieve CPI plus 5, so why take risks? And this is the outcome. And although they all end in the same point, I think it would have been probably, if one was running a product of some kind here, that drop would probably be something that one would rather have to explain in communications materials than that one. Moving on, same picture but 30 years, and similar kind of thing. And then for those people who can take a truly long-term perspective, not many of us perhaps, just for fun we have a 70-year projection. And there's obviously lots going on there, but the approach accumulates quite a healthy level of performance to everything else. So those are the results of the model which I'm presenting to you today. And I'm now going to hand back to Sid for a quick summary, and then we can have questions. Thank you.
I think this morning Bob Jager mentioned that over a long period of time in the US, I think since 1928, that equities have not delivered sufficient return to justify the equity risk premium. You can see here that over 70 years in the Australian context, only the contrarian rebalancing approach actually achieves its target, one being the target of CPI plus 5 over 70 years. The others, in fact, lag behind at the end of the day. So let me just recap, summarise what we've been trying to say here. First of all, we're saying that potentially better outcomes result when explicit account is taken of a preset target which reflects your liabilities or affected liabilities, say the solvency ratio, and rebalancing the portfolio. Intuitively, that makes sense. If you've got information, you know what your target is, you know what you need to try and achieve, then why not take it into account through the process of investment? Added value is generated through this process of de-risking when you're ahead of the game, and then increasing risk when you're behind. So a contrarian approach is required, which means that it's probably best done in an automated approach or via professional investors. Rebalancing to this target over time tends to perform relatively well, particularly in down cycles, which has attractions, as Andrew said, when you're trying to explain results to members in a defined contribution world. And in fact, potentially this approach could be developed into a pretty good default, perhaps, for investment choice overall. That's the end of the presentation. Michael?
Okay, thanks, Sid. So now we'll open it up to questions. So if anyone's got any questions, I'll ask you to speak into the mic. and say your name and your company.
David Schneider from UniSuper. Firstly, I'd like to say I really enjoyed the paper. I thought it was very well written, very thought-provoking. It's always important for it that we always understand the assumptions that we're dealing with, and clearly the assumption here is that of mean reversion. Now, I personally support that assumption, so I think it's a good one. But the question I actually have relates to a practical issue. If you're a trustee and you're looking at probability of technical insolvency at a point in time, yes, you have an automatic rebalancing strategy whereby you're increasing the proportion to equities, in this case to 80%. The trustee will also be looking at the probability of technical insolvency over a 1, 3, 5, 10-year period, which could be stochastically simulated, and may very well feel extremely uncomfortable increasing that equity proportion, and in fact may decide not to, being prudential in their way of thinking, which of course then destroys the very benefit of the entire rebalancing strategy. How would you propose that this strategy is applied practically?
Look, I think that's an extremely good question. And I think it's probably a difficulty that in one form or another many of the people in this room will have encountered throughout their working lives. The tendency of the boards that we advise or the investment committees that we advise to feel uncomfortable with that advice, and if not to do the opposite, certainly not necessarily to follow it. There probably isn't a perfect solution to this. I think it's a governance question, really. Sid mentioned that this is perhaps something which can work relatively well in an automated framework, and that might perhaps work within a product framework better than a large fund. Alternatively, one might just have the usual exercise of having to spend a lot of time educating the trustee. Thank you.
David, mean reversion isn't absolutely essential. I mean, rebalancing does work best in a mean reversion environment. Obviously, through history, that seems to have come through, at least in the equity markets. But it does help even in an environment where that doesn't happen for a long period of time. It does need to be automatic, I think. It has to be something that, you know, that is in a structure, a product structure problem. The reality is that it seems to work very well if applied rigorously. I think the concept of taking money off the table when you're ahead, that might be easier for trustees to do, to be explained to them and explained to the membership. And clearly, once a turning point is arrived at, that would then be vindicated. The hardest thing would be to put risk back on the table. I think the reality, perhaps, is that with this sort of thinking, it may encourage people not to leave asset allocations drifting. And there's a lot of evidence that that's happening around the world, not just here in Australia. So if this encourages people to think seriously about trying to keep the portfolio in balance, then it's probably doing its job to some degree.
Nick Khalil, thanks again for the paper. Really interesting stuff. Follow on from David's question, the thought crossed my mind, you do bump into technical insolvency or an equivalent sort of hard floor issue in insurance. But the saviour perhaps might be that typically, you know, the measures that you're targeting and that hard floor measure, there's a significant gap. So I just wondered, there's lots of directions in which you could take this, but you know, the idea of increasing risk when you fall below your headline measure, perhaps that's still a sound conclusion. But then, as you get closer to the hard floor measure, then I think it turns the other way, where you really can't afford to be below that. So whether this sort of concept of extending this to, it's obviously a complication, but to have sort of dual measures, one being your aspirational measure, one being a hard floor, and you get a sort of probably a pretty interesting shape of you start off adding risk, and then if you fall down too much further, then you've got to pretty quickly take it off the table.
And that's that's a feature of many, I think, insurance companies and superannuation funds in Europe too, I think, or pension funds in Europe, where they start to de-risk as they fall towards a certain solvency level or below, and which is, you know, could be described as that casino approach, done for clearly for solid reasons, but from an investment perspective, what we're suggesting is it may not be the ideal outcome to be de-risking once risky markets like equities have fallen so far.
I think it's probably worth just emphasising that all we've tried to do here is to put up a very simple model of the approach, and I would expect that implementation of it, whether it be in an insurance context or superannuation context, would likely be more complicated.
I'll give Glenn a go. And then you can go there.
Yeah, Glenn Langton. The two basic investment approaches, really, I see as contrarian and momentum. Right? I think if I understood the graphs correctly, that basically the momentum approach was a better approach for about 2003 to 2008. So there was a five-year period where momentum, so where this particular approach didn't actually, or underperformed the momentum approach. The concern that it's relatively easy to do in a defined benefit scheme because you can manage for the long term. I'd suggest to you if an investment approach underperformed for 5 years in the sort of accumulation environment, the investment manager wouldn't have lasted the 5 years. He would have been potentially sacked after three. And the business risk that the accumulation fund would have been running over that five-year period would have been substantial. So I'd just be interested in your thoughts on that.
Dear me, business risk. I thought we were in the investment business here. I'll take comment from the audience, but of course we have to manage these defined contribution plans with three things in mind. One is we're trying to maximise the long-term wealth for the members. And we've demonstrated that perhaps there is a better way than the current approach. We've got to be cognizant of our peer group, the business risk issues. And when you have a negative return, you've got to be cognizant of absolute returns and be able to hopefully demonstrate that your outcome is reasonable, particularly compared to others or the markets. If you're going to underperform, and I guess any process relative to the benchmark will underperform in certain periods, is it better to be underperforming in a raging bull market? And literally was a raging bull market with double-digit returns in superannuation for, David, 3-4 years in a row. And our target is CPI plus 5, which is high single digits. If you were to underperform by a bit during that period, is that explainable? Is that survivable? And then, of course, the payback is very substantial later on. So that's the issue, I think, that needs to be faced.
Yeah. I think just to comment, the approach that we're recommending has the difficulty of not being a natural human behaviour. People tend to go the other way. And so there's some interesting challenges there.
So, apologise for hogging the mic. I think the key issue I took out of the paper was actually the danger of the casino approach. Whilst I do have some concerns about the practical ability to implement the strategy in a defined benefit type setting or in an accumulation setting because of the peer risk, what this paper I think clearly demonstrates is the danger of going the other way, that that should be avoided at all costs. So.
Mike, did you...
Thank you very much. Sorry, Chris Condon, thank you very much for a great paper. I wanted to talk a little bit and get your comment on the financial planning aspects of this. There's a paper I read recently which talked about not managing returns but managing wealth, where it suggested that advisors should be looking at the long-term retirement outcomes that an individual wants, and then trying to achieve that, not trying to create this huge bequest. on a casino or lottery sort of approach. So that, I thought that was very interesting, and I really struggled to find people that are doing it in Australia. I'm really quite interested in progressing that. And then listening to your thing, I just contrasted, well, we see a bunch of other products that are sold, which are CPPI products, which do exactly the opposite and take you out just when you don't want to be taken out of the risky world. I wonder if you can comment a little bit about how this might be thought of from an individual's retirement planning perspective.
So you're talking about the financial planners themselves, Chris, how they would perceive it.
Well, no, the advice that they give, how they would manage that advice to their clients.
Yeah. Now, clearly, I'm not the expert on this. I don't know if you are. There may be someone in the audience who's better at it, but clearly financial planners are in the advisory business. They've got clients. Those clients are people, and they would be potentially thinking that the advice will be, when things are looking good, that the advice would be to be taking greater risk. We all know the potential outcomes of that. So the financial planner would have to be pretty strong and have plenty of credibility to be able to argue the opposite direction. I think that would be the business issue that they face.
John Sheed from SSGA. I'd be interested in the application from an accumulation point of view, and perhaps to pick up on Glenn's comment. There's obviously a huge degree of path dependency here in an accumulation context. And if I was starting out now with this program, I'd obviously have a completely different balance or allocation, which suggests that you're really talking about a life cycle kind of fund where you have a fixed date. And I know that in a product point of view, and perhaps to pick up on Chris's point, from a product point of view in other markets, lifestyle funds where, you know, I'm intending to retire in 20 years and I'm starting now, so I go with that cohort. And it seems to me that this, in an accumulation context, it really works in a cohort fixed life cycle kind of fund, which perhaps might reduce some of the peer group pressure or peer group risk issues because you've got such a carefully defined objective.
I mean, the thing about that type of investing, I know it's increasingly popular elsewhere and there's interest in Australia as well. Comment, in other countries like the US and Canada, it's very important to target a certain lump sum at a retirement age that then it can be converted into an ongoing pension. So it's not quite the same need in the Australian context, but it's coming. The difficulty is that often the changes in asset allocation are on fixed points or fixed ages, and of course what we're talking about here is a response to what's happening in the markets relative to that long-term target. So whether or not it fits exactly with it would be something to look at.
That probably leads on. Mike Murphy's my name. To my question, in terms of the timing of your rebalancing, one of the emails of early or middle side seemed to indicate it was a 12-monthly rebalancing thing. That's correct, is it? And I thought immediately of what would happen and what I personally went through thinking-wise in June last year and September last year and December last year when I had mentally assessed that I thought there was much more upside than down on each of those three occasions. And what, if you were doing this on a regular basis, where you'd be heading. But when you end up with the last slide and the 70-year view, which is the only one that worked and whatever, it made me think, well, does it actually only work when the target that you pick turns out to be correct? So you've done a CPI plus 5. If your target was CPI plus 3 and then you redo some of that at 10 and 20-year periods or whatever, what difference does it actually make? Because that was the thing that came to me when I saw the last slide.
Okay, it's a very good question, and we in fact did experiment with various different targets. We came to the conclusion that for the process to work in a useful way, the target has to be a reasonable stretch target. If it's outrageously ambitious, then the model is just going to try too hard and is going to push everything into equities, and it's not going to work anyway. So for the model to work, you really have to be in a range of reasonable achievability, I think. But yes, it does depend on that. It's a good observation.
Mike Barker. First of all, an observation. Looking at dynamic strategies such as this, I like to think of them in terms of the option jargon. And really what you're doing is you're writing a call and you're writing a put. And so what you're doing is entering into a short strangle. To comment on Nick Khalil's suggestion, what happens if the markets go further, and then what you're doing is you're buying a long straddle outside that, or you're buying a call to cover yourself. So yeah, it's actually a sort of more a butterfly. Anyway, getting onto the question. Now, when you treat this as an option strategy, you can do all the simulations you like, but what they really, whether they're successful or not, depends upon what strike prices you're setting and what volatility you're assuming. Unfortunately, you, from what you've said, you're using historic data, and so it's very hard not to be data mining in doing that. How much simulated stuff have you done with different assumptions? Because what I think Andrew just said, what appears to have been a reasonable assumption with 70 years hindsight may be very different from what is a reasonable assumption looking 70 years ahead. Have you really challenged it from a data mining perspective?
I think I might cheat here and ask the person sitting next to you, more or less, Andrew Leung, to answer the question. Andrew has done some forward-looking work, which I think is shortly to be published. Is that correct?
Hi, it's Andrew Leung. I can corroborate everything that the speakers have told you today. In fact, you can prove it mathematically, and you don't need mean reversion. That dynamic strategies work much better than static ones, even on a life cycle basis, where a life cycle strategy is a dynamic one, but it's fixed, it's inflexible. If you introduce flexibility, if you respond to what the performance has been up to now, then you get a much more efficient outcome in terms of risk. Does that answer your question? And of course, I agree completely. This sort of idea is perfect for designing life cycle funds, if you can market them.
Thank you. So, the short answer to your question is that there certainly was a risk of data mining in what we were doing, but I was aware of Andrew's work.
We might have time for one more quick question if anyone's got any further questions. Otherwise, we'll just... No? Okay, we might wind it up there. So thanks, everyone, for your participation. I think that made it a great session. Would you please join me in thanking Sid and Andrew?